Welcome to Think Orphan, the podcast for orphan excellence. Real talk with real people navigating the global orphan crisis.
Welcome back to the Think Orphan podcast. Thanks again for being a part of this podcast. You know, Brandon and I actually absolutely love doing this. It's something that we just not only enjoy spending time together, but more than that, we get to talk with just amazing people, which you guys know because you've been a part of this show, assuming you have been a part of the show. If you're just on for today's guest, well, I understand that as well, because we got another great one. But before we get to Caroline, Brandon, how you doing?
I'm doing okay. Yeah, I can't complain. You know, house is busy as always. You know, just trying to round up kids and this and that. But yeah, I got no complaints, man. How are things down there in your neck of the woods?
They're going all right. Going all right. You know, as we get into the new year and we're just trying to get things going. You know, it's always that post holiday kind of, okay, now let's just get into the rhythm again, right? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, it's always a busy house. You and I have both have pretty busy houses, so mm-hmm. It's a lot of stuff going on, and then to just kind of get back into that rhythm is always a challenge, you know, to get that going again.
Yeah, well, I found 2021 towards the end, the wheels were coming off a little bit. So we're trying to find a new rhythm as much as is possible. Obviously, life is never not chaotic or something like that. Yeah. But trying to find those healthy rhythms is really important. So hopefully people are getting that same thing here in the new year. So
yeah, and I imagine we're not alone in that. I mean, you say the wheels falling out, it reminds me of a van where the transmission almost fell out, but it pretty much needs to come out. You know, and those type things, there it's continually trying to not trying it's continually remembering that these are blips on the radar. In the midst of these things, they seem massive. They seem like, man, this is just, how are we going to get past this thing?
Yeah.
But I just, even before this interview this morning, I was just thinking, it's just money.
Yeah.
It's just money. Just take a breath, right? Like, yeah. Breathe, right? And it is. And it sometimes will overwhelm. And I think that how can we keep these things from overwhelming? How can we remember, you know, and take refuge in God's promises and just remember that he's got us? And in the midst of all these different things, as we're talking about these issues with everything that we talk about on this podcast, you know, God's got us and he's a God of abundance. So what does that look like? And so today we have another interview with someone who is working in some in India and some other parts of the world doing some incredible work. So who do we have, Brandon?
Yeah, this today we got Caroline Boudreau coming on from Miracle Foundation. They've been doing great work for about 20 years or so, impacting a lot of kids in India. And then they're actually expanding. They have a cool new foster care app that's actually rolled out here in the States. They're based out of Texas. And yeah, just doing great work. Caroline, we're going to get to talk about a few different things. And along with this episode, we'll also be having this season some youth from the Youth for Social Impact, which was a project that Miracle Foundation did to kind of support care leavers, which I thought was really cool. So this is kind of a one out of two for this season as we get to talk with Miracle Foundation. So we're excited to get into it with Caroline, who founded the organization about 20 years ago.
Hey, Caroline, welcome to the Think Orphan podcast. How are you doing this morning?
Doing great. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, we're really excited for this conversation. And, you know, and as always, as we welcome people into our space, we want to get to know you. We want our audience to get to know you a little bit better, too. Some people may have heard of you, may have watched your TED Talk, may have just to know about the Miracle Foundation. That's why they're listening. But a lot of people probably don't know a lot about you. So we always love to just kind of get to know you better, right? So can you just share a little bit about who you are and how you came to be working within the orphan and vulnerable child space?
Well, I'm Caroline Boudreau, obviously from South Louisiana. I lived in Austin, Texas most of my life. When I was 30, my best friend and I decided that we were going to take a trip around the world for a year. So we were going to quit our jobs and travel and see the world. And one of the places she wanted to go was India, because she'd been sponsoring a little boy there and she wanted to go meet him. And Philip, I have to tell you, I thought it was bunk. I thought there's no way this kid is real. They give everybody the same picture. I mean, I was like making fun of her the whole time. So we get to India in May of 2000. We meet the little boy she'd been sponsoring in good faith. He was real. He had everything that she had been promised that he would have. And so we started doing volunteer work there every day in this village. And the whole time I'm in this village, I'm thinking, wow, I mean, this is the base of the pyramid. I mean, these are the poorest of the poor. I'm so honored to be. I just thought I was looking at the poorest people on earth. I was wrong, unfortunately. We're there on Mother's Day. It's May of 2000. Mother's Day comes along. I get up in the morning, call my mom for Mother's Day, go work in this village all day, 119 degree heat, you know, crazy. And then get invited to this local's house for dinner. And we go to his house. We walk in his house and we walk into an orphanage. And my life changed that very minute. I was not prepared at all to walk into an orphanage, much less see 110, you know, hungry, empty looking, bald children. And so we had a beautiful dinner with them, a prayer service with them. And we were calling them Velcro babies because they were just attaching to us. And this little girl came and put her head on my knee. And like when you pick them up, they just push their little bodies into you. They just steal the affection. And I rocked her to sleep and I went to put her in her crib and I walk into her room with these wooden beds. And, you know, when I put that hungry orphan girl on a bed on Mother's Day, I heard her bones hit that bed. And it was at the first time that I truly understand what poverty really meant. I mean, poverty is when no one loves you. And so I started the Miracle Foundation that very day because I saw the human potential in their eyes. I saw who they were in their eyes and I knew that they were miracles. And if they just had a foundation, maybe they could thrive. And so that's why I started the organization. It's almost 22 years old and we've been fighting with honor and gratitude ever since.
Yeah. You know, that's something that it's hard for people who haven't seen the poverty and seen the situations a lot of these people live in to really understand it. Like you said, that you thought you'd seen the poorest of the poor and you hadn't. And I assume you have now. So that's part of what, you know, you see. And what is that as you come back? There's a lot of, you know, this is actually, folks, we talk about being off script. This is off script. This is something that I know that as I go and travel the world, and I'm sure Brandon is similar, when we come back to the United States, there is something that it's been a both and. It inspires me more to do more around the world, but it also is something that in me here in the United States to help people understand that we have responsibility with what we're given. So have you experienced that as well? Is that something that, or is it different with you? And this is something that I don't think I've ever asked this question on the show, but that's something that some people feel guilty. Other people, it spurs them on. And I'm just curious from your standpoint, how has that been with you when you are even today, every time you go somewhere else, what is that with you when you come back here to the United States?
Yeah. You know, I don't think it's such a geographic thing. I think it's more like, I'm just so grateful for what I've been given. You know, I struggled a lot in the beginning with the why question, you know, like, why was I given to two parents that loved me so dearly and they are not? And, you know, what, you know, like, what is, I mean, is this just a zip code lottery thing? Or, I mean, I'm just so confused about why I would be given the kind of life that I was given, the kind of foundation that I was given, and they would be left in the bushes when they were 3 days old for somebody to find them. Thank God it was a human, not an animal kind of thing. But I decided since I'm never going to answer that question, it's really just a booby prize. If I did get the answer to the question, it changes nothing. And so really it's just about what can I do about it? You know, how can I help instead of the why? And so then, you know, the other thing is I made a deal with God back on that Mother's Day, you know, and I told him that I would take care of his business if he would take care of mine. And that, you know, I don't think it was a mistake that I was in an orphanage on Mother's Day. I mean, who gets that? And, you know, I don't know if he thinks I'm dumb or dense or what. I mean, it was like a neon sign. It's like, you know, these kids deserve some help. And then, you know what, I think the other cool thing is when I was in the corporate world, which I came from a pretty corporate background. You know, I had everything that money could buy, but I didn't have contentment and fulfillment and peace and a feeling of making a difference. And so now I have everything that money can't buy. And it really is just it's a beautiful difference.
That's really well said. And, you know, one of the things I kind of want to highlight that I think is so important, how you defined poverty. You know, there's this really great publication called Voices of the Poor. You're probably familiar with it, that came out a number of years ago. When you talk with people that are in those most impoverished communities, they normally describe poverty in relational and emotional terms, not in physical and material terms. And I think that there's a lot to that. And as for me, I'm a student of transformational development, which was this, this view on community development, that was championed by some people that came out of World Vision. And it's a helpful thing because this is the same school of thought that Brian Ficker, you know, it's broken relationship with God, broken relationship with other people, broken relationship with yourself, and broken relationship with society. And I hope I got those four right. But that's what I hear in your piece as well. And, you know, interestingly, Caroline, I was actually first called to work with orphaned and vulnerable children on Father's Day. So quite fitting. Yeah. But I would love to dig in further with just kind of the experience that Miracle Foundation has had. Most of your guys' work has been in India. You guys have made a lot of progress there, impacted a lot of children and families. Can you maybe just give us kind of an overview of what you guys have seen in child welfare in India, and, you know, talk about what services are available? Obviously, you know, from the founder story that you just shared with us, it didn't seem like great services were available as you and your friend visited that children's home. But what services are available, and then what gaps are still pervasive when we look at child welfare in India?
Yeah. So definitely we can talk about India, but really globally, children are separated from their families due to poverty. So if there's one underlying factor, if there's one common denominator, it's poverty. So that's really the underlying issue that we're dealing with is poverty. 40% of children are separated because of death or desertion by their father. Now, if you have money or you have family with money, you don't lose your mother at the same time. But when your father leaves or dies, 40% of the children that are in institutions, that is the case. They're living without their father. And so their mother couldn't take care of them. You know, there's four things that have to change if we want a family for every child. And that's really, at the end of the day, our mission is a family for every child. I know that is a lot of people's mission. In fact, there's about 156 nonprofit organizations that are all working toward the same mission of a family for every child. I mean, that is something to be grateful for. That is an Achilles heel of nonprofit organizations, not being able to work together. But in this space, there's a lot of us working toward the same mission. And if you're going to have a family for every child in the first place, you really have to look at changing the narrative. So a lot of times people think that orphanages are great places for kids. I mistakenly thought if we can improve the standards of care in orphanages, children would do better. That was a mistake. Actually, we learn now that children belong with their families, that they do have mothers and families. And so, but you have to change the narrative. And I think the narrative is definitely changing. It's changing in India. It hasn't gone all the way to the ground, but it's changing. It changed at the UN level. It changed globally. And so that narrative really, really has to change. And it's changing in India. The second thing that has to change is the approach. So in India specifically, social workers and people that work for the government are the gatekeepers. You cannot enter legally into an institution without a government social worker approving that. And so the second thing you have to change is the approach. So Miracle Foundation partners with five state governments. We're in a big pilot. We're with five state governments right now in UNICEF, and we're training every single one of their social workers on what exactly what you're asking. What services are available for people? What questions do you ask where you can find a better placement? So just for example, girls as young as six and boys as young as eight know exactly who they can live with. They know who they can live with. They know if they're going to be safe. They know if they're going to be, because they all want an education and they all really want to make it out. They, you know, they have this kind of rigor about them. And so the second thing that has to change is the approach. And that means the people that work, the leaders, the expertise, the people that work in the system have to be trained, and their behavior needs to change. The third thing that you have to have is you have to have community assistance. So the community needs to know about the narrative shift and the approach shift. The community at the ground level has to know. And then number four, all stakeholders have to be included in the conversation. That's what I mean when I say we give girls as young as six and boys as young as eight the opportunity to sit on their own committee and make their own decisions. So India is definitely changing. India, I would even say, is a thought leader in the space. You know, we hear about Rwanda deinstitutionalizing, Bulgaria's deinstitutionalizing. There's some small countries in Eastern Europe that are deinstitutionalizing. India is deinstitutionalizing. And that's a massive, massive job. So India's changing rapidly. We're lucky to be a part of it.
Yeah.
And
Well, one of the things that you mentioned there, you know, when it comes to deinstitutionalization, you know, let's see, 2022, or sorry, it's 2022 now when this is released. 2020, we saw these rapid reintegrations due to COVID, and India was one of those, was one of those countries that had a number of their different provinces, states, you know, whatever they call them, that were rapidly sending kids home without proper preparation. And I'm aware of a number of kind of large scale child protection issues that kind of resulted from that. How did COVID kind of reshape that landscape, especially for such a large country that is also on this care reform and deinstitutionalization path? I mean, what did that look like for the people that you guys are working with in these states that you guys are operating in?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we were able to work with about 2,500 children that were placed back into their families without process. So 64% of all children in institutions in India went home during COVID. Now, if they can go home during COVID, why are they not home? Why the heck are they living in an orphanage? I mean, this really has to be our question. And so Miracle Foundation partnered with, we did two things. We partnered with 2,500 children and filled out our Thrive Scale on them. So we have a scale, we have a tool, and we ask questions on five well-being domains. So we look at the child's surroundings. Who's with them? Who do they live with? Who's around them? Is there some weird, strange uncle lurking around? I mean, like, who's taking care of these kids? Who's got their eye on this child? What, you know, what, who lives with them? The second one is, what is their household income? You know, if they are so poor, I mean, there are great plans, they call them schemes in India, for untouchables. There are great schemes for widows. There are schemes that we can put together with the families to give them an income. The third one is education. We don't have to sell this in India. India loves education. We're not having to convince people to educate their kids. That's not an issue. And then the fourth thing is mental health and health. And is there a doctor, and can the kids keep talking to their counselors? And then, of course, last but not definitely not least, is their living conditions. Do they have a roof over their head? Do they have a bed? And so we've been able to fill out this Thrive Scale for 2,300 kids. That's the first thing we did. And so that's going to prove whether they're permanently and safely home. And then the second thing we did is we worked with 3,000 families who had already taken their kids back. So before COVID, they already had their kids back, and we gave them cash transfers for a few months because we knew that they were the most vulnerable, that those are the kids that are most likely to get back put back into the system. And so we kept them alive for a few months with cash transfers. So COVID actually played into our hands as a group that wants children out of institutions. So it actually turned out to be a good thing.
Have you found that those children that were reunified back into their families have been able to remain there? Or did they have a time where they went either back into institutions or had some sort of disruption that led them to the streets? What does the follow-up look like?
Yeah. So our follow-up happens for 2 years. It's very much like an adoption, right? So there's this post-placement, we call it post-placement. The cadence is based on the difficulty of the placement. So if girls went to their grandmother's house, that's a pretty easy placement. If somebody went to somebody that they didn't really know very well, they went kind of home to a, you know, distant relative. We do more post-placement follows up. What we learn is that the breakdown usually happens within 6 months. Once you hit the 6 month mark, boy, the stabilization really just kind of, it's gelling. The nightmares happen within the first 6 months, and children, you know, are empowered to make the call. So, you know, in the United States, we might tell a kid, look, if there's a problem, here's a number you can call. But they don't know this person. They don't trust this person. In India, we're saying, if there's a problem, who are you going to call? What person would you like to have that first call with if there's an issue? And then they tell us who that is. We call that person and we say, hey, be on the lookout because Rajiv is going to call you if there's an issue. And they're always so honored. And they're like, he picked me. He picked me. And so then this guy's not going to wait for Rajiv to call him. He's going to call and check up on Rajiv. And so we've kind of created this 360 approach with it.
No, that's really awesome. And I love some of those services that you guys are providing in terms of post-placement support and so forth. I mean, those things are absolutely critical if we're going to see care reform done safely. So I really appreciate you highlighting those. You know, as I think about, you know, what is it that all of us are after? We want to see children in families and doing well in families, you know, really thriving, safe, loved, protected. Maybe if you could just, you know, from your guys' experience, what are some of those core elements that really establishes a firm foundation for children to reach their fullest potential?
Really, it's those five well-being domains that we track with our Thrive Scale. So who they live with really matters a great deal. As you know, I mean, who you live with makes a very big difference in your life. What that economy is in the household is really important. Your living conditions, your education, and your health and mental health. Those five things, if we can get those stable for children, children really, really do well. And then just to add just one finer point, you know, because we're talking specifically about India. India doesn't have foster care. India has kinship care. So these kids are truly going to someone in their own families. And we are finding that truly works. We are bringing that kinship care over to the United States and working in the foster care system in the United States, because it's really working where when you put children in foster homes with strangers, the chemistry is not there and it's really just not working. So this kinship care, India is onto something for the world to take a look at.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think that kinship care is, you know, a lot of these are collectivist societies. I lived for 8 years in Tanzania. And, you know, when we talk about alternative family care, even when we say, oh, kinship is alternative family, in a lot of these collectivist societies, that's not alternative family. That's just family, you know, that's just their family of origin. And there's actually a lot of those cultural things that we find in the global South that actually work better than anything that we have here. And so I appreciate you that you bringing that up, because I found that to be the case as well. And we have to look at those, you know, and I assume you're also friends with Ian Forber-Pratt, who's looked at a lot of these things and actually looked at India and the US. And we'll link back his most recent podcast with us in the show notes. But yeah, really, really great stuff, Caroline.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it is. It's important. You know, the United States deinstitutionalized in the 60s. You know, so it's a pretty old, antiquated system. So now that these developing countries are starting to deinstitutionalize, we have some modern technology that we didn't have before, and we should be using it.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because early on, like, the curse of knowledge hits us quite a bit. You know, when we're here, and I actually got bit by it earlier when I used, and I think you were taken aback by the question earlier, because I didn't define poverty, right? And I'm glad you did that, Brandon, when you talked about when helping hurts, and when you talked about the just the people in poverty, they define it differently. And I think that that's what I was getting at, and I apologize for not being clear on that, but that idea of we are, I think in the US, we are poor in a lot of ways too, that we don't see community poor. I think we're very community poor in most of the United States, not all. There are some places, actually most inner cities, where there is material poverty often are not community poor, which is an interesting thing that we need to say, how can we maximize the community that we actually have, that we need to take lessons from that. As you talked about, we need to take lessons from different parts of the world and bring them into our lives as well as we're interacting, which is why when I teach a class on this stuff, I talk to the students about it and talk with them about their experiences and say, what are you learning? You're not just going to quote serve the quote unquote less fortunate. I said that all that talks about is material poverty when you're exactly talking about that. And there's so much more to life. And so I love that you're talking about that thriving, that now what does that look like? It's not just about getting food in their stomachs. It's not just about getting a house over their head. It's so much more. And so I appreciate that. I just wanted to clarify that for folks out there who think we might have forgotten about what we've talked about on the show since the beginning. And you as well. So I just wanted to clarify that. But the other thing that we often, I think, miss is in our running of nonprofits. And in the United States, for some reason, it seems like nonprofits have become where people just say, well, they don't need to be run as well because they're nonprofits. They can be run differently than businesses because if you can get volunteers to come in and do stuff, then do it. Some of the things that I've talked to people though is you get what you pay for, right? Oh. I think is so true. I assume you agree with that. Can you just, your reaction tells me you want to say something about that right now. What do you think about that when I say that?
Oh my gosh. I mean, how do you hold a volunteer accountable? How do you give them KPIs? I mean, these are still at the end of the day jobs, and they're no joke jobs. This is a no joke deal that we're talking
absolutely
about children's lives here. Mm-hmm. And so while I so appreciate people saying, you know, my 12-year-old is very interested, can they come volunteer for your organization? I oftentimes say, what can your 12-year-old do for your husband's company, you know, or your company? What can they actually do? You know, can we give them a chance to be a kid and you come up and, you know, but we are, like I said, I came from the corporate world. And when I learned about some of these rules in the nonprofit space, I was shocked. Why can we not pay people? Why do I get dinged to grow my company? Why don't, you know, people don't want to pay for marketing. I mean, it's like, well, in one way I kind of get it, but don't we want to make the pie bigger? And that's really what we're trying to do with marketing. We're trying to tell more people about our work. So there's a lot of things in the corporate world that I was very used to that I came to the nonprofit space and just thought, well, this is ridiculous. This is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Yeah. We want to hire the best people for these jobs. We want really, really smart people. And sometimes you do get paid. You got to get what you pay for.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and it's something that when I'm talking with people about this and they say, well, why don't you just have people raise their funds, raise their support? Because that's become popular in a lot of nonprofits, that's become common practice in a lot of nonprofits where the people coming on staff, Campus Crusade is a good example. They have thousands of employees, and they all raise their own support. And I knew Dr. Bright and he said, I raise my own support too. And it's just part of what we do. But as I've said to people, though, the issue with that is if you really need the position, you can't wait for them to raise their support. You need to actually be raising that funding yourself. And as you know, I said, if you don't need it, then you don't need to have the position. So if you need it, you need it now. If you don't need it, then you don't need it. So I think we're in this support raising sometimes. We are actually inefficient because we take someone because they can raise support rather than, I think in recently you had another interview where you said in the nonprofit world, we get dinged for paying employees well and investing in marketing. This makes no sense to me. We are dependent on people to donate out of the kindness of their heart. And even though we do awesome, incredible work, it's very hard to know how much money we'll get in a year, which makes it hard to budget. If I got to spend the time I do on developing programs for the poor instead of raising money, the world would be a very different place for the 15,000 children we support. I can relate with that in so many ways where I talk to people where I go, I'd rather go and work and make money by helping people 50% of the time rather than raising funds 50% of the time, because then I'd actually feel like we're doing stuff. Because I'm not saying that raising funds is not a way to serve people and help people understand that they can be part of something bigger than they, than themselves. But can you elaborate on that a little bit more and what that looks like? Because we don't talk about that. We haven't talked about this. We've talked about talking about this on the show. We never have. And I'm glad we are. It's a great TED talk on it. I forget the guy's name who did it, but
Dan Pallotta did it.
There you go. There you go. Great talk on this topic. But can you elaborate a little bit more on that? As far as, I don't think people realize how much time does go into the fundraising aspect rather than the ideation and the creation of, you know, the innovative work that that we really need to be able to do. It's not just simply going out and feeding a kid. There's so much innovation that I don't think people realize. Can you speak to that? And what is not being done because we need to spend most of our time fundraising?
Yeah. So, you know, I don't mind fundraising at all. I'm thrilled to fundraise. I'm super happy to fundraise. Like you said, it gives people an opportunity to play in a game that's bigger than who they are. And they absolutely love it. And we can take money and make a huge difference for children. What I don't like is how I have to spend the money. I have to spend the money where I can't invest in my employees, which means I can't get employees that pay, that I can pay enough to really scale our program. And it's keeping us small. And that's really the issue, is it's just keeping us really small because of what we can and cannot do with our money. We can't pay employees well, we can't do marketing, we can't invest in infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So to the people that are donating, I think that there's some behavior changes that if those changed, it would be powerful. So for example, we are aiming for 2030. We're trying to reduce the number of children and institutions by 2030. We're cutting it at least in half by 2030. We have donors that have promised us an annual gift every single year for the next 9 years. That is game changing. Unrestricted, long-term, annual or monthly giving changes the game for the nonprofits. So when COVID hit, we were able to turn on a dime. We missed 2 months of programming because of COVID, because we couldn't figure out how to get, like, you know, all of our, we have so many social workers in India. We have so many things that just get deployed. But because we had unrestricted long-term giving, we were able to change our course, and we got tablets to children that had gotten home. We got Wi-Fi to children that had gotten home. We loaded those tablets with educational things in their own language, and putting Wi-Fi in their house. I mean, that is how we communicated with them. That's how we continued to do our mental health with them. And so the only reason we were able to innovate was because we had that kind of money. So the real question is not whether I pay people or whether I invest in marketing. That's not really the question. The question is, can we get donors to think about their giving the way we think about our health, which is more than not, right? So a lot of people only think about their giving one day a year, right? They write all their checks, they do it one day a year. Wouldn't it be more fun to think about our giving every single month? That's the powerful way to give, long-term monthly giving.
Yeah, and you hit on something there too, as far as the earmark gift versus the what is the greatest need for the organization? What do you need it for? And I think a lot of people like to give to, I want to control my giving to this. I'm going to give it to you so that you can spend it on that well, or that, you know, meal for the kid, or the whatever. You talked about the sponsoring a child to, you know, go to the kid, those different things. And I'm not saying any of those are not good or whatever, but from an organizational standpoint, I think it's difficult. I know it's difficult to run an organization when you have 16 different buckets that you have to take out of that. You can only take out of that bucket for a specific thing, but you need it for something else and you have nothing in that bucket. And so what do you do with that? Right. And so,
Exactly. And so dangerous. So we've had donors that say, I will donate every time you get a child from an orphanage into an institution. It's like, you don't want to make money my motivator, dude. You do not want me putting a child in an institution so I can, I mean, out of an institution so I can get paid for it. That is not the game we're playing here. You want me to evaluate on a case by case basis and only put them in a family when it's safe and whether they want to do it. True. So, you know, we just have some behavior changes. We have some learning to do, which is totally fair enough. I mean, I'm learning every single day. The thing that I think we all have in common is that we really want to be a difference and we really want to make a difference in a kid's life. And so you find an organization that you trust. I mean, obviously, you know, we're not in this for our you know, health. We're not getting rich off this. I was a lot richer when I was in the corporate world, but you know, you find, you bet on the jockey, you bet on the leadership, you bet on organizations that have a good track record. And then you let them do their job.
Yeah, that's right.
No, that's what I would agree. Yeah.
And I would just say, you know, hopefully donors are compelled by the mission that the nonprofit is going for and actually accomplishing. So they give because they believe in the mission. You know, the example that you give there, Caroline, as far as somebody saying that they'll give you money if you can, you know, take a kid out of an orphanage and put them in a family, that does set a very unsafe precedent. And unfortunately, I think when it comes to childcare programming, which it's obviously, you know, the vast majority of our listeners to this podcast are engaged in some manner, you know, around orphan and vulnerable children. When it comes to that specific type of programming, we unfortunately kind of boil children down to just kind of this transactional way of working with them, right. You know, and I think that actually even applies to the service provision. And that's something that we've talked about with Ian as well. But you know, this season, we're also looking at child sponsorship, which is kind of similar, just treating that kid like a transaction. Like if you do this, then I'll give you that. And, you know, we see this in short-term missions and volunteerism as well. And really, if we are going to run childcare nonprofits with excellence, we have to make sure that even in our fundraising, which we need fundraising and that our donors are also aware, is that we're not going to do anything that even hints of exploitation, right? We're not going to make money off the backs of these children, but rather you believe in our mission for these children. So you're getting, you know, behind our organization. And hopefully both sides can really, both the organization and the donor base can really embrace that type of ethos.
Right.
Yeah, we've been very successful in it. I mean, we've been able to shoot straight with our donors. I think that's one of the reasons that we've been so successful in fundraising is because we talk about these long-term, monthly, you know, committed, unrestricted giving and explain why we need that. And when we have a situation like COVID, which of course none of us ever prepared for, we were able to continue to give services to kids because of those great donors. So it was really a good day for us.
Yeah. You know, and I think that there are amazing people out there who totally get it. Like you said, Brandon, on mission, as you talked about, Caroline, the people who jump on board, we have those as well with Providence and it's just, it's incredible to see. And then I think that too many organizations though, do get caught up in what you talked about is those motivators where somebody will come in and say, hey, we'll give you $1 million if you do XYZ. That's really attractive. But if XYZ is not your mission, then you got to say no. Right. And I remember talking to a major foundation. They came up to me and they said, what's your cost per kid? And I just looked at them and we were running a community with family-based care, mom and a dad with kids. And I just looked at him and I said, you have kids, right? And he said, yeah. And I said, what's your cost per kid? I knew that at that point we weren't going to get the money anyway, but I think that that is something that we get driven by things sometimes that are not the right thing. Now, that's something that maybe some people do and that's what they do. But I think that, as you said, when you're dealing with human beings, there's no one set thing because different kids need different things and different homes need different things. Different families need different things. And so to say that we just have one set cost for one kid, I understand you can break it down. I understand all that, but to have that as your driver and as your marker to get those costs low so you could have a better ROI, man, that's a dangerous precedent to set too. Right. So what do you think on those notes, and you were in the corporate world for years beforehand. What do you think, you know, from an organizational health standpoint, what are some organizational mistakes that nonprofits are prone to make? And how can you mitigate against that? I mean, some of the things we've talked about probably already, but what are some other things that organizationally you see nonprofits doing that are just not healthy from a business for-profit standpoint?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, we talked about the metrics and we talked about the cost per child, and you talked, you know, that actually is about a 15-year-old model, where in nonprofits for years, nonprofits would just do the work and they didn't have any metrics alongside of it. And in the last 15 years, we've really added metrics, and they're powerful and they're really important. And we do need to count. We do need to measure. There's no doubt about it. You would never run a corporation without metrics, without, you know.
Sure.
You know, yeah. So that is really good. And I think more and more nonprofits have learned how to measure. I mean, we definitely have a Thrive Scale. We measure every single child. We know, you know, it all comes to this, you know, Salesforce database. We can look at all 15,000 kids in one go. So that's really important. There's nothing wrong with the metrics. What the next evolution, however, because that was an evolution to do metrics behind programs. The next evolution is commitment. The next evolution is having donors, stakeholders, children, you know, whatever the stakeholder is, coming together and communicating better. That's the next evolution. Donors saying, I'm committed. I'm going to stick with you. It takes a long time to fill up a dam. It takes a minute to break it, but it takes a long time to fill up a dam. And that's what we're doing with deinstitutionalization. It's going to take a while to fill up that dam. Committed people coming together. And, you know, in our space, there were a lot of organizations that came together to talk to the UN about children belonging in families. And successfully, there was a group of us that did that. It was awesome. We changed the Convention on the Rights of the Child at the UN level on December 18th, 2019. That is awesome. So the next evolution of nonprofits is our willingness and ability to work together. Now, on the ground, our programs need to look very different. You know, if you're in Kenya, that program and that strategy needs to be driven from the ground, from the actual stakeholders, to tell us what they need, because nobody, here's the secret. Nobody wants a solution to the problem more than the person that has the problem. Nobody wants to get out of an institution more than a child that's living in an institution. And so, bringing the stakeholders together and working together is the future. That's what needs to happen. And it's not that it's bad that nobody's doing it. It's just a missing piece. But we know when organizations come together, and we share marketing and we share resources and we share policy and we share funding, that is how you fix a problem and get to systems change forever. That's how you do it.
Oh man, that made my heart so happy.
That's what we do on this show. That's what we're talking about.
That's the
idea is to.
That's it. That's it.
People. It's like we paid you to say that, but we didn't. That I know. Was fantastic.
It's actually really happening. It's actually really happening. I mean, there's a group called the Orphan Myth Group. They came out. They're giving us these. They're giving us this marketing, this language. We should all be talking the same thing. We should all be saying the same thing.
Yeah, Orphan Myth, good folks. I've been talking with Lindsay.
Yeah, about really good folks. Stuff. We also in our space, that's the marketing side. We should be doing that, talking about the global goals, talking about the Orphan Myth. Then under resource, we have CAFO and we have Better Care Network. These are two organizations that take all of our resources, all of our tools, and put them in one place so anybody can have them. So, you know, our Thrive Scale lives on Better Care Network. We share our resources with everybody. Right. So people starting to share their resources. Powerful. That's the future.
Yep.
Policy, you know, we all came together to put that policy, and now we need to start sharing funding. So I see it, y'all. I see it.
Yeah. No, and I love it. And I think that too, when we start sharing stuff, when we start coming together, that's where, as you talked about too, metrics are key. And I know Bev Nyberg, I believe it's her last name. She does a lot on the metric side as well. And so as we develop metrics that work so that we have the right metrics, right? I think that's the key to the metrics, is not just having metric for metric's sake. Too many people get caught up in, we need to measure success. Okay, let's just measure stuff.
Bingo.
That's Bingo. Not what we need. We need to be coming together and say, what are the right metrics, rather than just saying, oh, we have 90% of our kids graduate from high school. I'm like, okay, that's one thing. But what if they're all like just languishing in morass of whatever else is going on, and they're all on drugs and they're all on this, but they graduated. Hey.
Yeah, cool. No, exactly. Shared metrics is also the future. Sharing, just, you know, measuring the same thing. And you know what? It might be a fruit salad. It doesn't need to be apples to apples. It can be a fruit right. salad. There's nothing wrong with that. But all measuring the same thing, like a family for every kid, is a really good place to start. Like right. all having the same goal. That's a great place to start. So
absolutely.
Yeah, we're getting there. I'm seeing it.
Yep, absolutely. No, all right, Brandon, why don't you bring us home, man?
Well, I just couldn't be happier. You know, 1 Million Home, we operate as a social venture. So everything we do is in collaboration and partnership. So, we kind of work as this catchment for these small to medium sized nonprofits, many of which people have already heard on the podcast. So hearing Caroline, you know, kind of even describe what she's seeing is just so encouraging, not only for what we're accomplishing here at Think Orphan, but also for our other organizational goals at 1 Million Homes. So just fantastic. Thank you so much, Caroline. You know, as we turn down the final stretch here, we do have a couple questions that we ask every guest. So for the last 5-6 years of the podcast, we are all about generating word of mouth. Holy smokes, goodness. All right, word of mouth recommendations.
Hey, so, it's early out here on the West Coast, so that's
early
okay.
out here on the West Coast. All right, so Caroline, what have you read, watched, or listened to that has most impacted your thinking on how we can love orphan and vulnerable children and families as well with excellence?
You know, when I first started in the nonprofit space, when I came back and I told my friends and family that I was going to start, a nonprofit venture instead of a for-profit venture, somebody recommended the book called The Road Less Traveled by M. Scott Peck. And they said, just pick up the book and read the section on love. There's 3 sections of the book. So I picked up the book. I read the section on love. I turned the book, started over at the beginning, read the whole book, turned over, started all over. But that book really totally changed me, because it said that love is either work or courage or both. You know, it's real easy to love someone who's so great to you and takes care of you and gives you everything you need and thinks you're just the cat's meow. It's a lot harder to love someone that might fight against what you want, but that's where really true love, you know, true love, that muscle shows up. So the book, The Road Less Traveled, even if you read the middle section on love, is something that just really changed me in my approach.
No, that's beautiful and definitely worth picking up. All right. So on the human front, what person has most impacted your thinking on how we can love orphan and vulnerable children with excellence?
Well, you know, I told you about putting that little orphan girl on that wooden bed on Mother's Day. Her name is Shibani Das. She's 22 today. She is in school. She's in college. She's a scholarship with Miracle Foundation. She's going to be an educator. She's changed my life, because, you know, I know on this podcast, we talk about OVC, you know, orphans and vulnerable children. I talk about OPC, other people's children, and how I can love this other person's child as my own and give up part of what I want to, you know, give up part of who I am so that she can be who she is. So, you know, Shibani Das changed my life. She knows she changed my life. She knows I talk about her every single day. She's just been a true inspiration to me.
Wow. Well, you know, these kids are inspiration for all of us, and, yeah. and that's why we do the work. That's why you're doing what you're doing at Miracle Foundation, why Phil and I are engaged and so many other people that really want the best for kids just like Shibani. So, thank you so much for sharing that. And Caroline, thank you so much for joining us on the Think Orphan. Gave us so much to think about and we just so appreciate the work that Miracle Foundation is leading within this sector. So thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Nice to be your partner. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, just a great conversation there with Caroline. So appreciate the work that Miracle Foundation is leading out in India. And like I said, they are starting to engage in other places. If you guys are in Texas, you can definitely look up their headquarters down there. But Phil, this was a new organization for you. This was my first time meeting Caroline as well. But what kind of stood out to you, man? What did you take away from the interview?
Well, anybody who talks about the next wave that we need being working together and collaborating and actually, you know, coming together, and she even threw out some systems in there. I mean, like, man, that speaking my language, you know. So I loved that. And it wasn't just words. I mean, they're doing it. They're working with others. They're sharing their resources. They're creating the Thrive Scale. And it's not just based on, you know, what's your weight and height, you know, that's part of it. You know, are you growing? Are you doing as we would with our kids? If they were stunted growth, we'd be going, what's going on? What's the problem? But it's more, so much more than that, you know, community, family, all the things that we talk about on the show that are critical. You know, they're doing and they're working on and they're learning. And that's what I like about it. It's not just let's do something. And just because it works, we keep doing it. You know, it works, meaning gets us money, gets us, you know, more kids, whatever. But it's, how are the children thriving? Are they flourishing? Are they, you know, and that's, you know, me, I mean, that's what this is all about. That's why we do this podcast. And so I was encouraged by that. And then the nonprofit conversation, that's a conversation we could spend days on. We could have whole conferences on that, as we probably should, to really be able to help us understand how we can engage people to understand that better. And how can we get people to understand that more and more and more, that we need, not only within organizations, you know, we need you to say, this is, something that we would do in the for-profit world, but amongst organizations too. We need to have organizations who are funded to foster collaboration, as we talk about with Providence, is Wilmillion Home, what you guys are doing, right? So how can we understand that if we're just going to do this as a kind of makeshift, let's figure it out, let's just, you know, kind of wing it, our results aren't going to be great. So that I just really appreciated that conversation. As you could probably tell, because you and I probably both had more, you know, kind of button into the conversation, let's say, in the interview than we normally do, because we're so passionate about these things. I'm assuming something for you, but I'm assuming that my assumption's correct on that too. So what did you think?
Yeah, well, I mean, I love the nonprofit conversation. It's something that we're going to touch on, you know, multiple times during this particular season of Think Orphan, because it's critical. It's absolutely critical. I mean, when I was in grad school, one of my favorite classes, and it sounds like a nerd class, but I loved it, was nonprofit leadership and administration. I mean, that class was my jam. I just loved it. So getting to kind of geek out and hear Caroline's thoughts and running an organization with excellence for 20 years, just really appreciated those sentiments and those thoughts that she shared with us. And, you know, it also gets to another piece that kind of stuck out to me. And it was almost kind of like an aside, but at one point in the conversation, she said, you know, at a previous time, we thought it was like this. We thought that if we just raise, you know, the standard of living for kids in orphanages, then they will thrive. And I think even aside from that specific example, I think that when we have these organizations or these leaders or these practitioners that are going at it for year after year, when they learn something and adapt, that's huge. I think a sign of maturity is that ability to learn, that ability to grow, that ability to look back and say, you know, I thought it was this way, but after we did that for a little bit, we realized actually it should be this way. And I think that that's amazing. I think too often we see, almost similar to what you were saying just a moment ago, people that get into a space and they say, well, this is working for me. I'm not going to shift. I'm not going to change. And then instead of, you know, taking 20 years of, you know, nonprofit excellence and, you know, trying to accomplish a mission on behalf of children and growing and adapting and expanding. There's organizations that spend 20 years just kind of stuck in their ways and not really learning how to grow, how to do better on behalf of children. So I just appreciated that as well. You know, that Caroline just kind of put as an aside, but it's that if we are going to grow and expand and impact more children, which is what we want to do, right? We have to also have that, not only a learning posture, but a willingness to adapt and a willingness to grow and a willingness to say, yeah, we actually had that wrong, but we're going to change now and we're going to do even better. So, yeah, so much that I appreciate from Caroline and she's such a leader in this space. So, just have the utmost respect for her and what they're doing at Miracle Foundation. So it was really great conversation.
Yeah. You know, and you talked there about the, learning, right? Leaders are learners. But you also said something there too. It's Jim Collins had the level 5 leader that's professional will and humility, right? So this humility, you can be a learner and not be humble. Mm. Right? So that humble learning posture where you're learning with not only an open mind to learn, but an open mind to how does this impact what some things that I see as non-negotiables, like they are non-negotiables in some ways, but can you tweak them? Mm-hmm. You know, I can learn from this other person who's been doing it longer or who is just a different perspective, right? Maybe, you know, as we talk about the care leavers, I mean, why are we not learning more from care leavers?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think it goes with knowledge and wisdom have to go together because knowledge by itself can kind of puff up. Yeah. And I think we see that we see that way too much, you know, especially in this age of fake news and disinformation from all sorts of different perspectives and angles. It's not even like, you know, that's kind of like a method rather than, oh, that's what that side does. It's actually what a lot of people from a lot of different sides do. And they're seeking after knowledge just to kind of be prideful and puffed up and try to shout down, you know, their arguments. But that humility and that wisdom is so critical if we are going to grow and do better, not only for ourselves, for our families, for God, but also for the children that we serve. So, right. Yeah, it was great, man. Speaking of growing in knowledge and wisdom, as we come to the end of our show here, Phil, I would love to hear, man, you got a recommendation, anything that kind of dovetails with Caroline or just something that our listeners should be getting into.
I do have a recommendation. I also just want to remind people that one last thing about the metric. I didn't say it during have your metric. I can tell you this for sure. Do not have your metric of success be you've raised enough money to fund your budget. That is not a good measure of success. It doesn't mean your mission's right. It doesn't. It could be that it is, but just because you raise enough money does not mean you're doing great work. I'm just going to say that right now. I'm going to leave it there. Okay. The recommendations. The first one is a recommendation that I can't believe nobody's talked about this book ever on our show. It's a book that, The Boy Who Was Raised as a Dog. if you listen to this show, you know that it has, but I'm just kidding. But I finally listened to the book.
Did
Brandon,
you? Oh, you proud okay, of me? Yeah. Well, yeah. It came up 3 times during the last season.
Yes.
Let's see. Kara, Tamra, and somebody else. I can't remember, but it came up 3 times.
Yes. I think, it was Caitlin.
Oh, and Caitlin. Caitlin, Hope. Yep.
So I did because I am a man of my word. And when people recommend it that many times, I'm going to listen to it. So I
was
did.
It good?
And it's fantastic. Yeah. Fantastic. I mean, not surprising. Okay. It was fantastic. Fantastic book. But that's not my recommendation for today. That was more of a bonus because I just had to let everyone out there know that I don't just say I'm going to listen to these things and we don't just get these recommendations for kicks. Like these are things that we do for a reason, but the two books that I think go along with this nonprofit conversation, one is one of the guru of gurus, in the nonprofit, well, not just nonprofit, but the just leadership space, organizational leadership space. Peter Drucker book, Managing the Nonprofit Organization, Principles and Practices. Most of the books written out there are cheating off of, they're basically plagiarizing without quotes, Peter Drucker stuff. It's the reality, you know, John Maxwell uses a lot of Peter Drucker stuff. Jim Collins uses a lot of Peter Drucker stuff. We all do, whether we know it or not. And then the other one I just mentioned, Jim Collins, Good to Great in the Social Sectors. It's a 35 page addendum to Good to Great, which is a great book in itself, but it's all you really need to read from the nonprofit space. Fantastic book that goes to what are the principles to run an organization with excellence, not just a great nonprofit organization, which I think sometimes has a different bar. So how do we keep that bar at that excellence, or that, you know, everybody say, if you shoot for perfection, you might hit excellence, right? So rather than shooting for this mediocre bar that we've created for nonprofits, we need to set that bar higher, and we need to shoot for that excellence, which I think that Peter Drucker, that book, Good to Great in the Social Sectors. Those are the two that I have for us today.
Love it, man. Okay. I'm adding those ones to my list because I want to dig deeper myself. And great that you got into Bruce Perry's work as well. So you're very diligent. I haven't read it yet, but I need to. So thank you for those, Phil.
Absolutely.
Man, this has been fun.
Yeah, of course. It's always great. It's always great. So folks, as always, we hope that you're taking what you're learning from this show and you're using it in your life, you're using it in, you know, your own home to the extent it applies. And we always, always hope that you're taking what you're learning and you're using it to help you to love orphan and vulnerable children better and better each and every day. Thanks a lot. Have a great couple weeks.
We hope you've enjoyed today's Think Orphan podcast. For all the information in this week's podcast, please visit us at thinkorphan.com. You too can be part of the conversation. Send your questions to info@thinkorphan.com or join us on the Think Orphan Facebook page. Thanks for listening, and we hope you'll join us again on the next edition of Think Orphan.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Ever tried reading while jogging, cooking, or even juggling flaming torches? Yeah, doesn't end well. But with audiobooks.com, you can conquer books without the circus act. Dive into over 450,000 titles, including more than 10,000 free ones. Get hooked on a bestseller. Find your next obsession. Or finally read that classic you've been avoiding since high school. And here's the inside scoop. Sign up today for a free 30-day trial and snag your first three audiobooks on the house. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.